Hello and welcome to Argue the Toss at GameIndustry.com. I'm Shella.
And I'm Drew, and together we're arguing about the things that really matter in games and films and stuff.
We are indeed, and this is Season 5, Episode 2.
Cool. Yeah, I remembered that one.
Yeah, it's easy to remember.
I have no idea which episode it is, but we've only done one this year. So.
Exactly. I always ask you, I was like, what episode is it? And you're like, no idea.
Today,
is it games, films, or stuff?
It's kind of all three.
It really is.
Yeah. We're going to be talking about Black Mirror Bandersnatch, which you must have heard of by now if you've been on the internet or on social media at any point in the last kind of month or so. Mm-hmm. And it's Netflix's new attempt at it's not their first attempt at interactive stuff. I think you can play Minecraft Story Mode, the Telltale mm-hmm. game in Netflix, but this is the first time they've kind of made a bit of original content as an interactive film, mm-hmm. which is written by Charlie Brooker, who obviously is a showrunner and writer for Black Mirror. And yeah, we've both played it. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a game and it's a film, and it obviously qualifies as stuff. We're fully doing the brief today.
Tricky one for charades.
Yeah, that is pretty good. Yeah. Oh, I'm going to have to put that away for next Christmas.
So I don't know how familiar people in the US are with Black Mirror.
I think since it moved to Netflix, there's certainly a lot of kind of Americans talking about it in my Twitter bubble.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, because Black Mirror's been around for a long time in the UK, and I suppose he's brought in American actors like John Hamm's been in stuff and things like that, which I guess helps with garnering that attention.
Yeah.
Over there, so yeah. So we don't need to explain the premise of Black Mirror then, perhaps.
No, perhaps not.
And Charlie Brooker's very dark brand of satirical sort of social commentary.
Yeah, very bleak and...
In the UK, he quite often, he didn't this year, I think because of Netflix, but he usually does a roundup of the year, which is hilarious because it's just so bleak.
I think it's kind of been a couple of years since he did one of those.
It was the best
from the White series in a while.
Yeah, it was the best thing about New Year was Charlie Brooker's sort of screen wipe look back at the year, which was just sort of looks at all the sort of celebrity stuff and political stuff and just has this his bleak look at the whole year, and it's usually hilarious. Obviously Bandersnatch, Black Mirror has taken over. It's obviously a bit more work than it used to be mm-hmm. churning these out for Netflix. But anyway, digress massively. So we watched it.
Did we play it?
Exactly. Yeah. We did both. Watched and interacted with it.
We did.
Do you want to do a sort of roundup of the story?
No, I don't, because it's very complex. So we can talk about the premise. We're going to have to get into the kind of details of the story later. I want to refer to him as your player character, but he's not really. You are watching this guy who is a game developer in the British 1980s kind of game development scene, and there's lots of references to that effect because, Charlie Brooker used to be a games journalist back when these games were coming out, so there's references to, like, Manic Miner and Pitfall and stuff like that scattered throughout, and Jet Set Willy and all sorts. So you play one of these game developers who is adapting a... No, you don't play him. Sorry, I did it again. So you're the character that you are watching... Oh, God, I've gone too deep. I've gone native.
I know. You've lost it.
Yeah,
he's lost to us. Yeah, so you're basically an omniscient sort of controller of various parts of the story. So as the omniscient viewer, you're watching this game developer who's, it's a bit almost Ready Player One in that this character, I can't remember his name. Do we have a name for him? Because Colin is the sort of, he's like the rock star game developer of the piece. And then there's the protagonist character who is an up-and-coming developer who's obsessed with this book called Bandersnatch, which is Choose Your Own Adventure. And he wants to adapt that into a sort of 3D sort of Doom-esque style, because everyone's still sort of on 2D as far as I could see. All of Colin's games were 2D, but he's going 3D Doom style adaptation of this Choose Your Own Adventure book, which is massive. It's the biggest Choose Your Own Adventure book I've ever seen in my life. I mean, it's like Dune, the Choose Your Own Adventure book.
Yes.
It's so big.
Yeah, it's really
yeah, which just kind of filled me with horror, kind of, just looking at the size of that book. And yeah, so that's the basic premises. He's a young game developer. He goes to pitch his game at, you know, Rockstar Collins publishers, and they're like, yeah, cool, let's do it. Well, at least in one of, yeah, in all of the scenarios, they're kind of like that. And they sort of, and then at certain points, the first point, it was, well, it's not the first point, but the first major pinch point is whether you choose to accept their offer or reject it. And then it goes on from there, really.
Yeah. It kind of uses that as a tutorial point, in that, like, it's a choice which has a very obvious yet correct answer. Like, obviously, you want to accept that offer. It seems like, you know, that's what you're here to do. But then you're told pretty much immediately, okay, that's what happens then. What happens if you choose that is that Stefan is the main character's name, which we were looking at. Yeah, sorry. You probably heard me looking it up.
I didn't. Okay, you got away with that one.
Well, there we are. Sorry, I forgot where I was. So if you choose that choice, Stefan, basically his game gets overtaken and stripped back and kind of corporatized to make it easier and more palatable, and you get a bad review at the end, and one of the characters explicitly says that you chose the wrong path, and then it rewinds you to kind of the beginning, and you get to go through it again and take the other option. So rather than it being a real choice, that's the moment at which the it kind of shows you what this is going to be like mechanically.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting way of doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then
everything sort of spirals out of control.
It is. And then so I mean, we kind of said before we started the show that we were going to I suppose before we get into whether that works or not and how it works, I guess we'll have a look at the setting and the characters and stuff like that. So this Stefan, who's kind of great as this really tightly wound young developer who has existing mental health issues, which kind of plays into the sort of semi-noirish, well, sort of psychological thriller aspect of it, which is, you know, sort of disorienting you as to whether it's in his head or, you know, what's going on. This sort of conspiracy theory and sort of sense of paranoia, I suppose, because he's on medication and he's seeing a psychiatrist and things like that. So we're never quite sure of what his reality really is. But he does a really good job at that kind of nervy. I mean, I empathized with him, and stuff like that. And then there's Colin, the rock star.
Yes.
I didn't really like that much. I think it's just because he sounded like Richard Ayoade from Garth Marenghi's Dark Place.
Oh,
All I
right.
could think is, like, my arse is grass and they've got a lawnmower. That's all that kept going through my head when I heard him talking.
Now that you've repeated that line, I can absolutely hear that. I didn't kind of notice it at the time. But yeah, he's got that very strange emphasis on different words.
Yeah, sort of like weird nasal talk like this. And I was just like, what is he doing? Because I know that actor from other things. So I was like, well, that's a strange choice, but okay.
Fair enough. So I hadn't seen him in anything else, so I just accepted that as whatever the actor's, Will Poulter, whatever his normal accent was. I'd never heard him in anything else.
Oh, no. Yeah.
And I thought he was really good. I thought it was a really kind of interesting and intense performance. Whenever he's on screen, he is the center of attention. I think he's really good at that. And partly that is that, you know, in the context of Bandersnatch, he is the rock star and he is the expert. And he kind of is positioned as, like, the shaman who it is hinted at that he knows kind of what's going on.
Yeah, he's and, a bit of a white rabbit character, isn't he?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And he's got, like, bleach blonde hair, like, white blonde hair.
Yeah. Seeing as this is Bandersnatch and it's you know, Lewis Carroll references, I imagine that's, you know, very direct.
Yeah.
Kind of. Because he is the one who eventually leads Stefan down a specific rabbit hole.
Rabbit hole, yeah.
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 Hadn't picked up on that. Yeah.
No, I hadn't either.
Literary references. They're great.
Yeah. but yeah, I mean, I didn't dislike him kind of, but I just felt that very conscious sort of speech choice just kind of pulled me out a little bit. But I like that actor and all the other things I've seen him in. He is always really good. And he was sort of compelling and the things he was supposed to be. And then, I mean, that's pretty much it for the other characters are just kind of side. There's the sort of angry dad.
I kind of liked him. I think he was a bit deeper than he originally appeared, because he's kind of set up as this character who doesn't understand Stefan and is disapproving. But in some of the endings, you see that he is, like, actually pretty supportive. Like, when the game comes out and it does badly, he's there to comfort Stefan. And he, rather than just being this unapproachable, distant figure. He does care about Stefan's mental issues, and he has, like, it's demonstrated that he has evolved from a previous kind of timeline which we see of his character, where he is the much more stern and unapproachable father when we see Stefan as a child. So that he does have a surprising amount of kind of development in for what he is.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. And then the only other person really is that, well, I suppose there's the publisher, who's just like a sort of
A
loud, sweaty, like, after the money kind of guy. So, yeah, sort of this pastiche of the corporate side of games, I suppose.
He just doesn't understand what's being gone for, like, so people tell him, oh, this is what this game does, and he's just like, cool.
And he's like, we need it out by Christmas.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. So, he's that and does that. And then there's the doctor who is just everything you expect her to be in that role, the sort of, like, questioning, gently questioning and, like, leading us down different paths. And then some of the endings and branches give her a bit more to do as well. Depending on which path you go down, she does different things. Some of them are quite surprising, and
she never really gets fleshed out as, like, she never has a deep part of the narrative. All of the endings that she has are kind of throwaway side-on things, which get, they're all kind of silly, or they're at least kind of metaphysical. there's no plot line in which she plays an interesting role in Stefan's story.
No, which you could think she could have, considering, you know, she's got sort of... She can prescribe him drugs and things.
Yeah, yeah.
She's in a position of quite a lot of power. Mm.
Sorry, go on.
No, that's it. I'd finished.
I guess the role that she inhabits is kind of... So it's sort of the antithesis to Colin. Colin seems aware that there are greater things in the universe of Bandersnatch,
yeah,
and that the realities are not what we see. She approaches the... She's investigative and she explains things, but she does it from a viewpoint which is firmly stuck within the timeline that she's...
Yeah.
That you're kind of going down. So she's the viewpoint from the inside, where Colin is the viewpoint... I guess he's from the inside looking out and she's from the inside looking in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's just the sort of... I guess she's kind of the Scully, the kind of...
She is.
You know, sort of like grounded in that reality and no other.
But like, oddly, the way she's played, you get the sense that there's something more to her. She's very suspicious. She doesn't... I wonder if I haven't seen one of the paths and there's something that fleshes out her character a bit more, because it seems like there are notes there that are not kind of played through to their conclusion.
Yeah, maybe. I just don't know.
No,
yeah.
We just don't know.
We don't. And so I suppose the setting is the... That's all the characters, isn't it, really, apart from, like, very minor. There was Kitty, the girlfriend, the random girlfriend with the baby.
Mm-hmm. And there is the guy who gets Tucker he gets like a curly whirly and a...
Oh yeah, yeah.
Totally from the beginning.
Oh yeah, he turns.
He was my favorite character.
Gets him a lion bar.
That's it.
Really old rapper. I don't even remember that rapper of Lion Bar.
Well, so... that sort of does lead us onto something that we wanted to talk about, is how well does this portray Britain in the 80s?
I think it does a really good job. It's basically compared to Stranger Things 80s, which is the 80s of adverts and sort of music videos and sort of John Hughes films, the 80s that didn't really exist, that we all kind of aspired to. That's like toy advert 80s, where all the kids have the cool things and everyone's got the most fashionable clothes and all their hair looks good, and they're not still wearing things from the 70s, which is actually what the 80s was like. People just trying to wear out their 70s clothes as quickly as possible so their mum will buy them something new. So as Bandersnatch gets the 80s, 80s Britain just like bang on. That sort of just like grub, it wasn't like shiny and neon. It wasn't like a Duran Duran video. It was like that. It was grubby and concrete. And the brightest thing was WH Smith's, because it was orange. And it was really cool seeing that old WH Smith's. So I was just like, is that really... There weren't any books in it. It was just music, and it just had a huge vinyl section. It's just like vinyl and video games. I thought they did a really good job of that. And then the clothes that the Doctor wore, she was sort of fairly, sort of stylish without being, like something out of a catalogue, which is what the Stranger Things always does, is like, it's the most 80s, like more 80s than the 80s has ever been. Whereas, she was just like, it was just really well observed in terms of costumes and settings. And they had lots of adverts in the back for weird stuff I'd forgotten. So which music did you choose?
Thompson Twins.
Yeah, me too. So I wonder what was on the Now This. That would be interesting.
Well, I actually went back and watched it with someone else. I watched someone else play through it just to see how their experience differed from mine. And she chose the Now tape. And I can't remember what was on it. It was just 80s music, you know?
Okay, yeah. And then
you get I was going to interrupt, but...
Yeah. Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, did you choose Tangerine Dream or the other one?
I did choose Tangerine Dream. The other one was Phaedra, wasn't it? Phaedra is a Tangerine Dream album. I don't know.
Yeah, I didn't know the other one, but it had a really cool cover. I know Tangerine Dream, so I was like, oh, I'll listen to these.
I mean, I know Tangerine Dream from the film Sorcerer, which they did the soundtrack for, and that's about it. So I selected them.
Okay, yeah, I was like, well, I know what they sound like. I know them, so I selected the other one, which is cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, I liked those two moments. And yeah, I liked the choice of music as well because it wasn't like the most 80s things, but it was still very set in that time. It was cool. Yeah.
The main thing that this has over Stranger Things is that in all of those stylistic choices, it shows some restraint.
Right.
Moderation, which is the thing that Stranger Things has no idea about.
No, exactly. I think they did a really great job with the setting. So I guess we should get onto the kind of mechanic and the interactive bit. So it's basically a simple sort of A, B choices. So you have like a sort of binary choice.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always one is kind of pre-selected. So I guess you can just not interact with it and sit and let it do the defaults for you.
They are randomly pre-selected, I think. There isn't a default, because I definitely remember watching it with a friend, and her choices were highlighted differently to the way I remember them.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, that's entirely possible. But the default at that moment, whatever it's decided at that moment. And you have like 10 seconds to decide your choice. It starts with which cereal would you like for breakfast, Frosties or Sugar Puffs? And apparently they did some stats of like the UK viewers versus kind of rest of the world. And apparently in the UK, hardly anybody threw their tea as an option at some point to throw your tea over the computer.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of
tea throwing moments. And in the UK, we do not throw tea. So I thought that was quite funny. And we chose Frosties over Sugar Puffs.
I haven't seen this. You're going to have to link me to this, because I'm really interested in like kind of the mechanics of this game.
So I thought that was funny. But I was mainly like, but then I might short my computer if I throw tea over it. I wasn't saving the tea, I was saving the computer. So the game was written in Twine, which I'm guessing most of our listeners will probably know, but it's a tool for writing interactive fiction that's been around. It's very well established. So Black Mirror is basically a Twine game with a fancy sort of like film wallpaper on the top of it. I guess you could like strip it back completely and just play it as a text adventure. We were talking about it before, how the criticisms have been divided into several camps. So there's like the camps of people who are in the industry, like particularly people who write games and interactive fiction or write about games or are familiar with interactive fiction, And then there's people whose minds have been blown. Who just like, this is just incredible. I'm like controlling the TV. So there's that, those two sort of levels of different reactions. So some people saying, oh, well, this is nothing new. This is just, you know, a Twine game, on TV. Kind of cool, but whatever. And then you were talking about the differences in responses amongst the interactive fiction community.
Yeah, like it seems to have divided that community down the middle a bit as well. I mean, there's one side which is sort of, okay, this is nothing that hasn't been done before. It's not necessarily a particularly great Twine game if you strip away the extra stuff that's added on top. Because it ends up being, rather than using the format to tell an interesting and continuous story, it starts investigating, you know, the illusion of choice and what is choice actually in a game like this, which is something that has been done before infinite times in kind of the history of interactive fiction, and like the Stanley Parable kind of goes into the same issues and I think does it quite a lot better.
Much better, yeah.
Yeah, and then there is the other side, which is like, well, okay, fine, but this is how the art form gets advanced. Like, up until now, you know, nobody kind of knew about, like, Twine games and interactive fiction beyond, you know, the community that's already into them.
Beyond it's not us,
public. Yeah, exactly. It's not publicly kind of in the limelight, but now it is because Bandersnatch was in the news everywhere. Like, people went kind of nuts for it.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, there seems to be a divide on whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. And I don't think it's as clear-cut as that, but you can certainly kind of see both sides.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, basically, I think it's cool that Netflix has done an interactive fiction experience that, you know, everybody... So, I mean, because before it would be... You know, when I describe my job, for instance, like writing games, or describe my game, you know, Windrush Tales, which is, you know, a illustrative interactive fiction, I'd maybe struggle to describe it to someone who doesn't play that sort of thing and say, well, do you remember Choose Your Own Adventure books?
Yeah.
And now people would probably say, oh, do you mean like Bandersnatch? So it can become that sort of shorthand for a wider audience, which is kind of cool. But then, yeah, I understand the sort of, you know, the sort of chagrin of the community that's, you know, we've done this. It's not good interactive fiction, it's going over really old ground, and it's preoccupied with the mechanic and being clever rather than like telling a good story. So yeah, because it is both of those things. But then that's kind of often the way when something reaches a mass audience is it's not always the best example of that that medium.
No.
Or but genre or whatever.
Now the system is in place, you can imagine that and given how popular Bandersnatch has been, you can imagine that Netflix are going to be looking for other writers to come in and have a go at this. So there's like a lot of chance that we'll see something that uses the same mechanics but does something a bit more kind of satisfying at the end of it.
Well, and Sam Barlow of Her Story, he's currently doing something like film-based. So, yeah, I mean, I have put a lot more faith. I mean, Charlie Brooker is a great writer, and Black Mirror has been consistently, you know, like, brilliant, which I think is partly why Bandersnatch is sort of disappointing, because it's neither a good Black Mirror episode nor a good interactive example of interactive fiction. But I think Sam Barlow, who, you know, did Her Story, which used sort of film footage clips and did interesting things with, you know, sort of splicing the narrative up, I can imagine that he'll do something really exciting, which will be cool. And I like the fact that Black Mirror has now set up an audience for that, which might not have been there otherwise, because lots of people who watch Netflix have no idea who Sam Barlow is and has certainly never played her story.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. They've used star power to build a massive audience where one wouldn't otherwise exist.
Exactly.
And, you know, I can imagine that Twine itself must have seen kind of a pickup in new users since Bandersnatch came out.
Yeah, that would be cool. Yeah. That would be good as well. So I think it's a cool and exciting thing. You know, I don't think we need to get precious about it or feel sort of, like all the hard work that's been done already is being devalued in any way. I think it's just cool if more people know what we're doing and want to have a go. I think that's cool.
Yeah. So.
So, what's Bandersnatch? Why do we think that it isn't a great example of interactive fiction?
Well, I mean, I already mentioned the idea that rather than telling a satisfying story, it opts to explore the concept of choice, which is it's kind of heavy for something you just... I mean, it's Black Mirror, so you're expecting something kind of philosophically interesting, but it's in games and in interactive fiction, it's well-worn ground. So I don't think it brings anything particularly new to the table. Mm-hmm. It's also kind of limited by having to film the scenes that it has. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in a Telltale game which uses, you know, a very similar kind of choice system, the game is not filmed, so it can react to any choice any kind of way it likes. It can introduce much more variation. With this, you become aware very quickly that you're just watching a lot of pre-filmed segments, and that your choices don't really have much of an impact on, you know, what you're going to see.
Yeah, there's that little delay after you've made a choice.
Yeah.
Which just is, you can hear the machinery.
Yes, you can. You can see the strings.
Yeah. And the story just, it's not, I mean, you don't feel, because as an interactive fiction, it doesn't work because there isn't really a goal. So your choices don't really carry any weight because you don't know what you're trying to achieve.
Yeah.
Because at first I was like, so am I trying to ensure that his game is successful? Yeah. And then I was like, am I trying to stay alive? Oh, now I'm trying to not kill my dad. And I know that partly that's the point. Because he's playing with choice and all this sort of thing. But ultimately, that's kind of just... you're just kind of boring, like, in a narrative. From a narrative perspective, because that's ultimately what we want, is we're here for a story.
And by, like, it kind of leaves the story to the player, because it gives you these choices, and whichever choice you choose, you're not making choices that kind of affect the narrative. You're making choices that diverge the narrative entirely. The narrative itself is centered on the choices. So you're not working within the framework of a story. You're just given free rein to kind of branch out into whatever nonsense you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, none of the endings feel satisfying. It doesn't feel like you've achieved a goal, because there isn't a goal. There isn't a through line.
Right. Exactly. I mean, the ending I liked the best was... I mean, I didn't get all of the endings, because you were saying the one that you felt was the most satisfying was one I didn't see, that I only read about afterwards. So the one I found that I liked, and I was like, you know what, I could stop now, but it gave me the choice to watch the credits or go back, so I went back because I knew we were doing the show and I wanted to see more of what was going on. Mm-hmm. And that was the one where I got I put toy as the code into the thing. Yes. And I got the rabbit, and he gets the train with his mother, and then he dies in the doctor's not surgery, but in the doctor's office, and I was like, oh, that's a really cool ending, because we'd leave him on the train as a little boy with his mum, and I'm like, oh, I wonder if the train now doesn't crash or what's going to happen. And then I wasn't expecting the ending that I did get, and I thought it was really cool, and it was kind of satisfying.
I'd forgotten that one, and it is a really kind of interesting ending.
I thought it was cool. Because it also does that thing, you know, the sort of the obsession with sort of dying in games, and you know that you don't kill off your, I know he's not a player character really, but he is our protagonist, but he dies, and so that's as game over as you can get, really. That's, you know, it's like a complete permadeath on that one, but obviously not, because I got to go back. But yeah, I thought it was really satisfying and worked kind of thematically and with the character, because, you know, he found life tough, and he was you know, that was a clinch point for him, sort of emotionally, was losing his mother and feeling like it was his fault, and so being able to go back and undo that, even if it meant that he died. You know, he was happy in that moment as a little boy then. His dad was kind to him. He went on the train with his mother, and then that was it. So I found that really satisfying.
And just to go back to the Lewis Carroll metaphor, so he goes after it, like, is it a white rabbit, the toy that he has?
Yes, it is.
And he goes through a looking glass.
Oh, that's right. He does. Yeah.
Like, just, how did I not notice these at the time? They're so kind of.
I suppose once you tie into the Alice in Wonderland thing, which I didn't at all, which is weird considering it was called my favorite Bandersnatch and, book as a child, the book I read most.
Well, yeah.
I could read both of those in a day, back to back.
I've never read either of them, but
oh, really? No. They are brilliant.
I'll just watch the Tim Burton ones. They're probably good enough, right? I heard you recoil. So, any other kind of cool moments? Anything that you really enjoyed it in?
I really liked the visual effects they used for when they were taking the trip.
They were
really cool, and it just made me feel like they were done or directed by someone who knew what that experience was like. It didn't feel like movie acid trip.
It didn't start swirling the camera around.
And all that sort of thing. Exactly. Just getting sweaty and falling over. It was just like a really cool effect when there was that painting of roses on the wall, and they just did this really beautiful kind of marbling effect and stuff. And when he's had like lights tracing off the ends of his fingers and stuff. It was like the whole room didn't start swirling. It's just when he looked at certain things, they did something. I just thought it was like a really cool, like really kind of restrained and sort of subtle effects. When they could have gone like, woohoo, we're on an acid trip. And then the thing when Colin took his glasses off and his eyeballs kind of like
that was so drooped. Creepy.
Yeah, it's just so cool though. It's such a such a good effect. It was good. So I really enjoyed that.
I thought it was cool that in that scene, so that scene kind of ends with Colin taking you out on the balcony and saying, okay, there are millions of different timelines, and like it's not clear whether he knows or whether he's just on drugs. one of us is going over the balcony right now.
Yeah.
And you, like, first time I did it, I thought, right, okay, I'm going to do it, see what happens.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, and you kind of restart and come back up to the same thing. Mercifully, the game lets you fast forward through all the stuff that you've already chosen to get back to that point.
Yeah. So did you get him to jump? Because I never got back to there.
Okay, so if you get him to jump, he kind of disappears from the game. Like,
oh,
it's really interesting. Like, even, I'm not sure whether it works across timelines. I got the sense that it did, but he doesn't show up again until kind of quite late when what's her name, the girlfriend,
Kitty,
that was it. She comes back looking for him. She goes, "Well, where is he?" And you're like, "I don't know," but you kind of do know because it happened in a different timeline.
Okay,
it's a very confusing moment because you're like, "Did that happen?"
Okay, yeah. So that's kind of good. That's kind of nice.
Yeah.
Oh, so did you say the ending that you thought was the kind of main ending we were trying to determine?
Yeah, the one that I thought had most claim on being a main ending was, it's like, it feels more like a main ending because it starts intercutting with like credits. It's not one of those things, okay, where you get to an end point, you can choose to view the credits or go back. It's right, showing you the credits while it's doing this. And basically, it's the daughter of Colin Rickman, the game developer, it's showing her in an interview in the present day, talking about how she's working on Bandersnatch for Netflix. Which is, like, it's a bit insufferably metaphysical, I think.
Right.
But, like, it's the ending that most... it's the most satisfying ending that you get, I think, because the theme of the whole thing is that he's making Bandersnatch to recreate a choose-your-own-adventure book, which it's hinted that it drove its creator insane. And then he, like, in this ending, he gets driven insane as well, and then she is doing it on Netflix, and it hints that she's starting to see the kind of choice symbol as well, mm-hmm, and she's having the same things happen to her. Yeah. It's a bit wanky, but it is the one that, like, kind of continues the theme from beginning to end.
Yes, that's true, as opposed to the one that's just satisfying for him as a character, on the train as the child.
Because as I recall, that one just cuts to, do you want to go back or do you want to watch the credits now, rather than, you know.
Oh yeah, it doesn't have that, you know, interspersed credits, but yeah, but just sort of narratively I was like, oh, I like this ending, and I was like, I'd be happy to leave it here because it's, yeah, it just feels nice. Even though he died, it just feels complete. But yeah, that does feel like thematically that's come full circle.
Yes.
Yeah.
But in the same way, like we were talking about earlier, it doesn't feel like this was the path that you were always on. It doesn't feel like the story was leading to this conclusion. This is just a conclusion that happens to tie off previous things in a vaguely satisfying way.
Yeah, because lots of the endings are just like, oh, right. You're just like, okay, you just admit, you don't kind of think about them, because,
yeah.
I mean, ultimately, I didn't care that much.
No. No, I think you're absolutely right. It's not something that you get really invested in.
No, which I sort of expected I might, because the reaction that, you know, the internet had made me think that that's what's supposed to happen. But I did have a feeling that I might find it a bit hollow. And I did. But I think, you know, that doesn't take away from the fact that it's brought, you know, like we've said already, interactive fiction to a broader audience, which I think can only be a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, yeah, it's cool, it's not good. But
yeah.
Yeah. That's the best I can say about it, really.
I know.
Which is really damning with faint praise. Like, I didn't dislike Bandersnatch. I enjoyed the experience.
Yeah.
It's in the aftermath, going back and looking at it and analysing it, that you kind of... It becomes a little unsatisfying. You think, okay, there wasn't actually that much there. In the moment, it's really good. It's really fun to watch. It's really fun to play. But it doesn't leave much of an impression in the end.
No, it doesn't. Sort of narratively or the characters or anything. I think that's all I've got to say on it, really.
Yeah,
I think it's cool but not good is a great place.
cool but not good. They should put that on the poster. I don't know where you put a poster for a Netflix interactive experience, but there probably is one.
On the side of that bus that's still got Philadelphia on it.
Yes.
Oh dear. Was that you that posted that?
No, it wasn't, but I did. I think I saw you.
Was it Mark Drew, perhaps? Yeah, so one of our friends on Twitter posted a picture of a bus that had a London bus that still had a poster for Philadelphia, you know, the film from like the 90s on the side of this bus. Yeah, so. Yeah. So that's where they can put our poster.
Yes.
Says argue the toss.
Yeah. Cool, but not good.
Yeah. And on that note, are we doing our wrap-up thing?
I should say so, yeah.
Okay, so you can reach us on, we're doing, where are we these days? We're on
Twitter, at argue the,
yeah. Oh. At Argue the Cast on Twitter, and then we are on iTunes and Spotify, and of course www.gameindustry.com/podcasts.
Is it slash podcasts? It might be just find the podcasts link on the main page.
Yeah,
but we're definitely there.
We are. Yeah, we've always got we've always got one of our latest episode. Our last episode is always up on the front page anyway, so you can click on that and then you'll find them all. But yeah, come and say hello. Say hello to us on Twitter. That's always nice. And give us a thumbs up in the place that you listen to us. That's also very cool. And that's it, I think.
It is.
This was Bandersnatch. This is Argue the Toss. Until next time, Drew.
Cheerio.